In the coming week, Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu tries to form a governing coalition. U.S. lawmakers seek billions of dollars for emergency coronavirus funding, and the world remembers flight MH370 6 years after its disappearance. It's March 5th, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Stephen Cook, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Stephen is CFR's ENI Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and North Africa Studies, and he's joining us for the second week in a row. Stephen, welcome back.
Happy to be here as always, Bob.
Well, last week, Israel held its third national election in the past year, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party won the most votes, but neither it nor its leading rival, Benny Gantz's Blue and White Coalition, have earned enough support to secure a majority in Israel's parliament, the Knesset. So where does Israel go from here, Stephen?
Yeah, you know, it's extraordinary. This is what I think people were expecting, that there's been this kind of seesawing of results. The first election, Netanyahu did slightly better than Benny Gantz's Blue and White. Next election, Benny Gantz's Blue and White did slightly better than Netanyahu's Likud. And now Likud has, again, under Netanyahu, has a few more seats than the Blue and White coalition. But neither of them have, as far as the counting goes right now, have enough seats to form a governing coalition. I think there's a number of scenarios. I think Netanyahu, because the Likud party has more seats, is going to be tapped to try to form a coalition. And I think what he'll try to do is pick off lawmakers from other parties that might be willing to join his coalition. It's going to be a hard thing to do because those are the seats that he controls, about 58 seats. Those are the seats of the right. And he may be able to pick someone off from the Blue and White coalition. But it strikes me that the Blue and White coalition has really come together, as we discussed previously, not necessarily so much on policy differences with Netanyahu, but really personality.
But on the issue of Netanyahu himself, who right. I guess in a couple of weeks faces the corruption charges.
Right, that's exactly right. Now, that's one possibility that he tries to pick off people from other parties and entice them to join Likud, and then he would have the seats. The other one is a national unity government where Gantz and Netanyahu agree and have a grand coalition. That has happened in Israeli politics before. It happened in the 1980s where Likud and Labor sat in coalition together and they rotated the prime ministership. The problem is for all of these months, for now almost a year, Benny Gantz has said he will not sit in coalition as long as Likud is led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Doesn't seem like Netanyahu is going anywhere anytime soon. The corruption allegations, the indictments, have not soured a large portion of the Israeli public on Benjamin Netanyahu. So we'll see what happens. The third scenario is that Netanyahu fails to form a government and that Gantz forms a government. He could have a minority government with outside support from the Arab parties, which did very, very well in this election. And Gantz certainly, you know, if you look at the numbers, Netanyahu has 58 seats. That means there's 62 non-right-wing, non-Likud seats in the parliament that Gantz can play with. So there's going to be intense negotiation and a lot of horse trading going on in the coming weeks. We'll just have to see what happens.
And you mentioned in your framing of that, the name Labor, there's a party whose stock has basically evaporated. Is there any Labor presence at all? Could they consider possibly joining forces?
Well, Labor's long-term decline has come to a point where it is in coalition with two other smaller left-wing parties, and I think they have about 6 or 7 seats. Let me take a look what we have. But it, you know, this was the party of the founders of Israel. They are in coalition with Labor, a party called Gesher and Meretz, and they've got 7 seats. They're down 2 seats. So it's really very much a shadow of its former self. But it could sit in coalition with Blue and White, and it would, you know, certainly add to Gantz's totals. But again, I think that the most likely scenario is that Israeli President Ruvi Rivlin will give Benjamin Netanyahu a chance to form a government. If he can't, then once again, Benny Gantz will be tapped to try to form a coalition. We're going to go through this again and again.
A lot of deja vu all over again.
Exactly.
Yes. We mentioned on the last discussion as well that regardless whether it's Likud or Blue and White, essential foreign policy areas are not looking at a big difference between the two at the end of the day.
They really aren't. And again, this is not, you know, things like President Trump's peace plan are not the things that Israelis were voting on. There are critical issues in Israeli domestic politics.
Infrastructure.
Right. Your kind of basic meat and potatoes politics, plus big questions that have been raised about the relationship between religion and state, given the fact that Netanyahu has sat in coalition with religious parties and a former Minister of Defense, Avigdor Lieberman, who heads a party called Yisrael Beiteinu, Israel is our home, is standing on principle. He does not want to sit in coalition with the religious parties because he feels as if they are granted all kinds of privileges that other Israelis aren't, and that there needs to be an evening of the playing field, and that it's expensive for the religious parties to have these kinds of exceptions. They don't serve in the IDF. Most of the men, you know, study in yeshiva their whole lives, yet Israeli society basically carries this growing population. So that's the Israeli election. And like you said, it is, as Yogi Berra once said, deja vu all over again. Bob, let's now turn our attention to another situation that we've been monitoring closely. And that is the spread of the novel coronavirus, known as COVID-19. Just yesterday, Wednesday, March 4th, U.S. lawmakers, at least in the House of Representatives, have reached a deal to provide $8.3 billion in emergency aid to combat the rapidly spreading virus. Bob, what's going on? What's the state of play?
All right, well, let's go through the numbers first, Stephen, to sort of stake things out. So we're now in a situation where we're getting very close to 100,000 total cases worldwide. Still, a large majority of those are in China, 80,000 plus, but it's growing faster outside of China than within China. There are signs, many experts say credible signs, that it is in fact really slowing in China, which would be good news. However, three other large countries often mentioned as other areas of concern continue to grapple with a big problem: South Korea, Italy, Iran. Iran, in an extraordinary way, is seeing it affect its highest levels of government. A chief aide to the supreme leader has died from the virus. We had an extraordinary situation where the deputy health minister was speaking on television and was visibly showing signs of being afflicted, and in fact ended up testing positive for the virus as well. So it's affected up to 10 to 12 members of parliament. So Iran's having a problem, and it seemed like it's also a problem of information and of Iran being kind of a vector for this as well.
Yeah, you know, I saw just today that Iranian health officials were saying that Tehran is going to spread like wildfire through Tehran and affect a large proportion of the population in that very, very large city.
Yeah, and Italy, you've got now the whole country, I believe, is now looking at its school closures for a number of weeks. It's also sent shutters through tourism, not just in Italy, but in Europe as a whole. There's stories coming out about popular tourism sites, especially in the spring when you have sort of the spring break season. They would like to have people visiting, but many people are chilled by getting in a plane for a number of hours at a time of an incredibly contagious virus. Continuing with the numbers, Stephen, of the close to 100,000 cases. We've had 3,300 deaths. WHO gave a new estimate on the mortality rate, which is still a little bit contested, but they said 3.4% of the people getting it died.
That's up from what they said a few weeks ago, which was about 2%.
That is right. And it's still, by the way, contested by, among others, President Trump, who I think is downplaying the concern level, still seeking to try to combat the problem. And the U.S., by all signs, you know, U.S. health experts are certainly seized of the matter. But we'll see if this extra funding goes through and what the impact actually is, Stephen, in terms of testing kits, in terms of maybe the government helping localities deal with this, picking up some of the TAM testing. You're seeing reports about people who've been quarantined being faced with thousands of dollars in medical bills, which is essentially unheard of outside the United States. So it's among the many challenges facing the U.S. in coming to grips with this. It's about 140 or so cases as we went to tape this podcast, Stephen, and a few anomalous sort of outbreak cases. You've had a severe number around a nursing home in Washington State.
Seattle is under a state of emergency.
Seattle in a state of emergency. You have the New York suburb of New Rochelle. One family became kind of the focal point of an outbreak there that's affected at least 10 or so people at this point. 30 other people, I think, are self-quarantining who are in contact with this family. New York City itself, I think, still has a small handful of cases. But it's running into, as I said, not only sort of the broader tourism season. We've had global supply chain interruptions. The U.S. is starting to take stock of the extent to which it relies on China for pharmaceuticals,
right?
90% of some antibiotics.
Right. Forget the antibiotics. You can't get Purell.
Yeah. And then you have the hand sanitizer
and the
problem.
Hand sanitizer. Yeah. There's been a run on that. If you want to get those Clorox wipes, even if you have Amazon Prime, you're not going to get it for some time. It's been a kind of interesting response. There's been people have been pulling up to the market and dumping Purell and wipes into their cars. But at the same time, at least here in Washington, I've noticed people going about their business. See on the metro, no one's really taking any kind of special precautions for what might happen. Whereas you point out in Seattle, there is a state of emergency. There is a cruise ship that is now off the coast of California.
That is right. That's right.
And the authorities there are now helicoptering test kits out to the ship because a passenger who had been on one leg of a cruise a number of weeks ago had contracted coronavirus. There's a lot of new things that are happening and people are reacting very, very differently. I think the most important thing is people wash their hands and stay home if they don't feel well.
Yeah. And you're also seeing a number of pieces taking stock of sort of what the global response has been. I mentioned the WHO, which is sort of in the forefront on certainly being the place where people look to to for guidance on what's happening. It's a little bit disheartening, though, to see some of the global response. Just to cite one example, first week in February, I believe, WHO put in an appeal for $675 million to stand up an emergency response, a global emergency response. As of last week, there had been three responses totaling $1.4 million, Ireland, Slovakia, and an NGO, which is extraordinary. It's extraordinary.
Well, you mentioned Congress. The House has passed an $8.3 billion emergency spending bill. But as of this morning, there were a number of senators who said that they were concerned about the cost of this. It strikes me that this will not be the first nor the last global health emergency and that we want to build the infrastructure. Some of the problems that people have encountered in places like Seattle is that they've had to so quickly kind of stand up a response that there's a lot of confusion about who's responsible for what, getting test kits. Those things will get ironed out as time goes by. But at the same time, we really do need to be ready. And my hope is that other places that haven't been affected by it are taking stock of what's happening in places where there are clusters of the disease and they're building up infrastructure. But without that kind of funding, the additional funding, it's going to be much harder to do it.
Meanwhile, you know, there's an ongoing crisis watch going on for anybody who's going to any sort of mass event, whether it is sort of conferences, academic conferences, things like the Final Four tournament in the NCAA.
Right.
That'll get everybody's attention if precautionary steps are taken to sort of whether they have the games without crowds or have to cancel them completely. That is certainly going to get Americans' attention.
Right. In Europe, they're playing soccer matches without crowds. That usually only happens when the team or their fans have done something terrible.
Yes.
But now it's to protect people from the spread of the virus. And I saw something just the other day where there was even some discussion about postponing the Summer Olympics, which would also be rather extraordinary. I don't know. I don't remember, at least in my lifetime, the Summer Olympics ever being postponed. I remember the United States boycotting the Olympics in Moscow in 1980, but I don't remember them ever being postponed.
That's correct. Other than wars, I think that is the only thing that's interrupted the flow of Olympic Games on the quadrennial flow. Steve, I'm going to take us in a different direction because in the days ahead, there's going to be an anniversary. It's the sixth anniversary of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 mysteriously disappearing on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Much of the story still remains unknown, but Stephen, tell us what we know at this point.
This is one of those stories, especially if you're a frequent traveler, that kind of freaked me out at the time. Malaysian Airlines flight 370, coming out of Kuala Lumpur, heading to Beijing, disappeared from radar about 39 minutes after taking off from Kuala Lumpur. There was a transmission from the pilots. It seemed routine. Vietnamese air traffic controllers then lost the plane.
So it was last over Vietnam.
It was entering Vietnamese airspace over the South China Sea. The pilots were handed off, what they call in aviation. They were handed off from controllers in Malaysia and told to contact Vietnamese air controllers. They said, okay, thank you very much. Have a good night. They never contacted the Vietnamese air controllers. The Vietnamese air controllers could see the plane and then shortly after entering into their air jurisdiction, the plane disappeared from flight. And this, you know, the news coverage and the disappearance, there's just no trace of this plane whatsoever. And the conspiracy theories and the constant news coverage of this was really rather extraordinary. And to date, the plane has never been found. There is some more information about what might have happened to the plane. A journalist, an aviation journalist named William Lagenwish, I hope I pronounced that correctly, he's done some extraordinary work on
he did basically the definitive piece on it.
Right. Yeah. He did the definitive piece on this in the July 2019 issue of The Atlantic magazine. I will say, just as a matter of full disclosure, I used his article on the crash of Egypt Air Flight 990 as secondary source material in my book, The Struggle for Egypt. I had gotten the NTSB reports on it and then used his article to fill in some of the gaps for me. He's an extraordinary writer. And what he has discovered by looking at radar tracks and going to the backgrounds of the command pilot during the flight is that it seems likely that the senior pilot, the guy who actually wasn't flying the plane at the time that it disappeared, but clearly took over the plane, depressurized the entire plane, killing all the passengers on board, and then set it on a course south into the deep Indian Ocean, where eventually it ran out of fuel and crashed into the ocean. Now, why would he do this? You know,
And he seems to have found some fragments that washed up in Madagascar. Is that right?
Right. There are some fragments that have washed up in Africa, in Mozambique, and other places. I believe it was Mozambique. But the most of the evidence for this theory that the senior pilot took over the plane, killed everybody aboard, and then crashed it into the Indian Ocean is based, like I said, on the radar tracks and looking into the pilot's background. Now, the news reports at the time said, you know, he was this fine, upstanding pilot with tremendous experience, which is all very true. But he was also having significant problems at home. He had moved out. He and his wife were separated. He had unrequited love for another woman. And he also had a pretty elaborate elaborate flight simulators set up in one of his homes, and what they've discovered is that he practiced this track. So the circumstantial evidence is that the fault lies with the pilot of MH370 for its disappearance.
And so at this point, even though there's so many questions, it does seem like there still is a sort of some closure that's required, maybe of authorities in Malaysia or other international authorities?
Right, and the Malaysian authorities have issued their own report, but no one has gone so far as to actually pin the blame on the pilot. And so there, for the families, and there are families of many, many different nationalities on this plane, there's no conclusion as to what happened to this airplane. And that must be, of course, extraordinarily difficult for them. But it is one of those great mysteries that has remained unsolved. And like you said, there's only been fragments of this plane that have been discovered that have washed up on shore after months and months and a number of different efforts by different governments, the Australian government, the Malaysian government, an international coalition of private companies to actually find MH370. And they've come up empty each time. Moving on, so our figures of the week. This week's figure coming to us by our Twitter poll is Joe Biden. Bob, why did our audience select Joe Biden?
Well, Stephen, he's part of a stunning political comeback that we've witnessed in the past week. Recall in the first three contests for the Democratic primary season, Joe Biden was one of the big disappointments. Former vice president, longtime well-known senator from Delaware, very strong foreign policy figure for the U.S., both as a senator and a vice president, and yet was not generating any kind of traction as a candidate until South Carolina held its primary over the weekend, and then followed just a few days after by the Super Tuesday event for 14 states. Biden was the big winner in South Carolina. He got a major endorsement from an African-American lawmaker. And
James Clyburn.
James Clyburn.
Senior most African-American lawmaker from South Carolina, member of the House leadership team.
Exactly. And has ridden that basically into, as I said, a stunning series of victories in not only in the South, but in New England. Bernie Sanders held his own in a few Western states, especially the big one, California. But Biden now leads in the delegate count.
By about 60 delegates,
right? Roughly 60. Still some delegate sorting out going on, actually. But it has basically overhauled the whole prospect of the Democratic race. There's this now sort of pitted contest between the revolutionary Sanders against the restorationist Biden, as it were. And I'll leave it to the pundits, and there are many of them out there, to sort of sort out exactly what's going on in the minds of Americans. But it's a fascinating time with this vote taking place and the high turnout numbers in many places as well. It's a fascinating time to see this campaign now take this move.
At the risk of offending any of the pundits out there, I would note that 10, 14 days ago, they said that Senator Sanders was the clear front runner and would have all of the advantage going into Super Tuesday because he had done so well in Iowa and won in New Hampshire and won convincingly in Nevada. So the all of the kind of the narrative was in favor of a Sanders victory on Super Tuesday. And yet with the Clyburn endorsement, Vice President Biden really has just come back from what people thought that campaign was dead and buried. And here he was, 10 out of 14 states, and kept Sanders within single digits in California, which is a pretty good total, especially in California, where apparently Biden didn't really have a lot of infrastructure, didn't have a lot of offices there, didn't have a big ground.
Well, that was one of the other stories, is that in some places where he was barely active, he defeated handily Mike Bloomberg, who spent overall almost $500 million,
right,
with major operations in a number of places. Biden was a candidate who resonated. I should note that also CFR has a candidate issue tracker on its site of foreign policy issues and what the candidates' positions are on them. And the Joe Biden page has surged in page views. And if you go there, you'll see on the one hand, somewhat of a sort of a centrist mainstream foreign policy set of views. He, first of all, definitely acknowledges climate change, wants the U.S. to be in the Paris Climate Agreement, wants it to be in the JCPOA, the Iran Nuclear Agreement, approves of the USMCA trade deal, but has other skeptical views on others and concerned about the impact of globalization. So there's some crossover there with Senator Sanders. But it is worth taking another look at some of those positions on a number of really important areas where the challenges, and let's add the virus to that, are only mounting.
Right. I don't think that this race is just over quite yet.
No.
There's a lot of big states that are yet to vote. Florida, Michigan, there's a lot more to go here. So we may see another wild swing in the narrative about the Democratic presidential primary.
And with the latest reports that Elizabeth Warren has dropped out, it'll be very interesting to see where her followers end up casting their support. Stephen, let's keep it going on the figures. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Well, my figure this week is a number, and it's a number based on the UN, and it's about 15,000. And that's the number of migrants who have tried to cross from Turkey into the European Union by way of Greece as a result of the increase in fighting in Idlib, all the way on the other side of Turkey, and the pressures on the Turkish government to accept more refugees from Syria. The Turkish government has abrogated a deal that it has had with the European Union to stop migrants from crossing into the European Union. The European Union has been paying billions of dollars to Turkey to keep these people there. But the Turks are very frustrated with the European response to what's been happening in Idlib and what they feel is a lack of support for Turkey, and actually its military operations against Syrian regime forces there have basically opened the borders. There was a report.
So they had closed those borders. They had closed off the possibility for would-be migrants to leave that way.
That's exactly right. And those borders had now been thrown open. There was a report from the Greek side of the border just today in which the Turks were essentially not manning those border posts. And the government-friendly press in Turkey, which is, I should say, is a large proportion of the press, has essentially been encouraging people to cross into the European Union. And buses have showed up in neighborhoods of Istanbul, and people have gotten on and have been driven directly to these border posts. The Greek government is reinforcing its side of the border with military
forces. Which is already dealing with an unwieldy problem involving migrants.
Huge problem. All over the Greek islands, there are large numbers of refugees trying to make their way into the European Union. It was a real crisis, especially it came at the same time that Greece was having very significant trouble of its own economically. Greece is doing a bit better, but it certainly can't handle this flow of refugees. So the Greek military is now reinforcing its borders, and the European Union is moving to help the Greeks keep these borders closed. The concern is that with more migrants coming into Europe, it'll have more of a distorting effect on European politics. And the theory is, and I think it's a good one, that the right wing, the nationalist right, neo-Nazi parties in Europe, which have been there for a long time, have fed off of the anxiety over large numbers of people arriving in these countries and have used it to gain politically. And that's a significant problem. Of course, you know, the large numbers of Syrian refugees in Turkey has also had an effect on Turkish politics. Things were okay, and the Turks were touting their role in the care and feeding and protection of these people until the Turkish economic downturn, and the Turkish opposition started hitting President Erdogan over the presence of so many refugees, and he changed his position on it. So the idea of accepting perhaps a million more is putting tremendous political pressure on Erdogan. And so, unfortunately, what the Turks have done is essentially weaponize these poor people. None of the people, by the way, who are crossing or trying to cross into Greece are refugees from Idlib. Turkey's borders, southern borders, remain closed to those people who are caught between three armies there. It's the people who have been already in Turkey for the better part of the last decade.
And some of them are from as far away as Afghanistan, I think, too.
Right. They're not only Syrian refugees, but there are many Syrian refugees. There are Afghans, there are Iraqis who Turkey has hosted for all these many years, and they are actually being encouraged to leave. It is an extraordinary situation there, if only because, one, the weaponization of these people and the response of the European Union is kind of military response from the European Union. And it's truly a breakdown in relations between Turkey and the European Union that has long been incoming, but I think this is a rupture that it's hard to see how it can be repaired.
No, and there's an international system set up to try to deal with surges of refugees and migrants and would-be asylum seekers and so forth. And it's basically, it's overheated, short-circuited, whatever you want to use, term you want to use. It's clearly inadequate to the task. And I fear that 15,000 figure that you said, Stephen, is only going to swell.
Oh, it's almost certainly larger than that, but that's what the UN could track. The Turkish government says it's closer to 80,000 people, but that's almost certainly not true.
Yeah.
Also, you know, it's important to point out that up until this point, for the most part, the Turks have upheld international standards which is in contrast to previous refugee problems that they had.
If you're a refugee and you end up in a Turkish refugee camp, you're better off than in many other places.
Right, that's exactly right. So it's an unfortunate situation. As we've gone to record this podcast, President Erdogan is in Moscow talking to President Putin about how to manage the Idlib situation. Their relationship itself has frayed a bit, well, quite a lot, but there doesn't seem to be an answer to the Syria problem, and there doesn't seem to be an answer to this massive problem of refugees and how to deal with their suffering. Well, after that very depressing topic, Bob, who or what is your figure of the week? And I hope it's something uplifting.
I want to bring us up, Stephen. So I'm going to choose a person. And it is a woman, a Congolese woman named Semida Masika. And excuse me if I pronounce that improperly. She is, at this point, the last patient treated for Ebola in the DRC. And one of the ways I found out about it is on my feed on Twitter, I started to see these UN-sponsored videos of an impromptu little parade among healthcare workers in the DRC. And it was it was joyous. It was a wonderful thing to see. And it was also a reminder that there are things that the world can get right and can fix. This was the second worst Ebola outbreak in history.
Wow.
It mainly confined to the DRC. It had killed thousands. And the world community responded, the WHO and lead actors, having learned lessons from the previous outbreak that had killed 11,000 people, helped to confine it in a time of great danger to healthcare workers, some of whom were killed
right.
in the process during
whatever minimal press coverage right. there's been in the United States.
Absolutely.
The stories were health workers who were being attacked as they were trying to deal with the Ebola outbreak in the DRC.
That's right. So now health officials warn just takes another case for this to pop back up again and become a concern. But at this point, there hasn't been anyone showing signs of this in 14 days. Again, I would refer people to the video of the impromptu celebration with, you know, plastic canisters, people are banging, and sort of a little mini parade going on to just sort of celebrate something that the world pulling itself together can get right. Best wishes to Semida Masika.
Bob, I appreciate that because it really is a good story, and I think we need some good stories. Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. Climate activist Greta Thunberg takes part in Europe climate strike. And Holi, the Festival of Colors, is held in India. I have to say, having spent about 3.5 weeks in India in 2013, it is a country in technicolor, and so there should be a festival to colors in India.
Well, please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Special thanks to Anu Kumar and Catherine Pope for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Anthony LeBarry. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Stephen Cook saying goodbye.
This is Bob McMahon saying thanks for joining us, Stephen. And so long, everyone.